Folks, this is great watching. That's right, that's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes and aeroplanes, and Lenny Bruce, he's not afraid. It's the eye of a hurricane, listen to yourself turn. Simon, it's the end of the world as we know it. We are talking apocalypse here on the podcast. This is screen watching. We talk about movies, yeah. We talk about TV shows, as those are the end of the world, people.
And they really are.
This week on the show, we're going to talk about Leave the World Behind. It's a brand new apocalyptic drama, a movie, a feature film debuting on the Netflix. You can find it in cinemas right now, though. It looks at the end of the world. And then we're going to dovetail that into a conversation about our favorite end of the world movies. I'm also going to talk about another TV program. That one is called Faraway Downs, which watching that, I wish that I had experienced the end of the world and then I wouldn't have had to watch Faraway Downs. Simon, what are you talking about?
Well, Bottoms Down. I'll be talking about Bottoms. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this very special episode of Screen Watching. After I talk about Bottoms, I'll also be talking about something that threatens the world as we know it, and that is Godzilla. There's a new Godzilla movie out, Godzilla Minus One, and I'm very excited to chat about that. We'll be looking at some of the other things we've been watching, a little show called Bookie, A Murder at the End of the World, some history, some birthday, and birthdays are very relevant this week because this is our 150th episode. So, Dan Barrett, congratulations. Well done, my friend. 150.
If this is 150, is it time for me to be truthful?
Yes, I think maybe. We'll see. We can edit it out.
I didn't watch Bookie. I probably shouldn't have had that on a run sheet. Anyway, folks, this week's podcast, it's going to be huge. The stakes are high. Stick with us.
This is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher, mother,
secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
When I began the week and I started filling out this spreadsheet, a rundown, some may call it, I looked at it and thought, you know what? I'm not that excited about this week. I don't want to do this week's podcast. I mean, the shows I had. And then I did some rearranging of the shows and the movies. And now this is the most excited I've been about any podcast. And I don't want to just dilly-dally or just muck about. I just want to dive right in. Let's go straight into the reviews.
It stinks.
I'm very excited. I'm going to kick this one off. The new comedy in cinemas this week is called Bottoms.
Could the ugly, untalented gays please report to the principal's office?
Guess that's you guys.
Tonight is our night.
We're getting the cooch.
I'm going to talk to Brittany.
You could say hi to Isabel.
What would I say?
Hey, girl, how's your boyfriend?
How's his penis?
This is the new comedy from the pair known as Emma Seligman, the director and writer, and Rachel Sennett, who stars and also wrote this film. They made the terrific Shiver Baby, which made both our end of year lists a couple of years ago. They have a very unique voice when it comes to telling stories from a strong female perspective. And with Bottoms, they've used the template of the old sort of 80s teen comedy movies and turned it into an ultra progressive but also very sly and subversive take on millennial / Generation Z mindset and mores. It features Ayo Edebiri. Gee, I hope they said that right. You're a fan, of course, from The Bear. Did I get that right? Oh, I called you Take Your Drink. You got it right. Her and Rachel Sennett play gay girls in high school who decide to start up a self-defense club as a way of getting women into their circle because nobody really likes them and hopefully finding a girlfriend out of it. And they get a very mixed bunch of women who come along to this self-defense class, which very quickly, some say deteriorates, I would say escalates into a fight club type scenario where they get to act out rage on each other and ultimately, you know, work through some peccadilloes as well. It doesn't turn into the lesbian free-for-all that the two girls are hoping for. Instead, it becomes a female empowerment class that takes on a lot of importance to all the girls that are involved with it, except the two that invented it. It puts a strain on their friendship. It puts a strain on the new friendships they've made through the group. And ultimately, it finds a way for them to reach their goal in life, but also help everyone else out at well. It's very clearly cut from the same cloth as things like Clueless, if you're a kid of the 90s, or Revenge of the Nerds, if you're a kid from the 80s. But the dialogue and the language is so sharp and so on the money in terms of breaking through the craziness of what it means to be a teen nowadays, and finding really well-sketched characters within that. I love Bottoms. I laugh so hard. When you finally get with the rhythm of the film, it feels like a real movie comedy. And by that I mean comedy of late has kind of build up, punchline, whereas all the humour in this, even the stuff that's fairly grand in the way it's staged, comes entirely from all the characters involved. They're all such well-written, well-sketched characters that I was totally on board for the journey, no matter which way the film wanted to take me in terms of the character trajectory. So Bottoms is one of my favourite films of the year.
So Shiver Baby came out, and as you said, it made our best of lists. And I think Shiver Baby, if I'm not mistaken, was my favourite film of whatever year that was. It was like 3 years ago. I think something like that.
Yeah.
So my anticipation level for this movie is very high, and it has been frustrating that it's been about 3 or 4 months since the US release of this movie. So I've been pottering backwards and forwards, just trying to work out, when am I going to see this film? When can I see it out? And it's managed to come out in the worst possible week for me, where I don't know I can get to the cinema to see this, which is very annoying, but I'm going to make an effort because, first of all, all reviews have said that this is laugh out loud, proper funny, very keen to experience that in the cinema again, even though I know I'll go to the cinema and it'll be like three other people in the theater, because boy, you've got to get that cinema energy to really appreciate movies, I'm told by enthusiasts. So going to get along to that, but I also love that they are keeping it to, I think, under 90 minutes. It's like an 88, 89 minute runtime.
Yes, it is.
And I'm super excited to get to the cinema, just get my thrills out of it, and then get out of there and get in the car and go home and watch some more TV. I'm very much down for this.
And you're absolutely right. It moves at a cracking pace, this film, but doesn't sort of jettison any important character moments. The chemistry that Rachel and Ayo have in the lead roles are just terrific. The other standout character is Ruby Cruz, who plays sort of their 2IC in the Fight Club. She plays Hazel, and she is very, very funny and holds her own against these great sort of comedic talents. And the other person in there that of note is Kaia Gerber, who's a breathtakingly beautiful young lady, because she's the offspring of Cindy Crawford and Randy Gerber, Hollywood royalty now for a couple of decades. But she has some great sort of throwaway lines that are exactly what this film needs at key moments. It's such a cleverly written film. And although it was an audience of influencers that I saw at Winston with at a preview screening through the week, we were all laughing in unison, and everyone really appreciated that kind of comedy. So, yes, you're right. It is tough to get a cinema full enough nowadays to have that group experience. But if you can, this is one that certainly benefits from finding that unity with its audience.
Yeah, like all movies, it's best seen at a preview where you've been given some free drinks and free popcorn before you go and see a free movie. But Simon, getting back to it, Ruby Cruz, I really liked her in Willow for the first couple of episodes of that series. So, you know, very cool to see she's part of this. But to me, like I talked about my interest in seeing this based on Shiver Baby, but part of it is that this has been the year of Ayo Edebiri, The Bear, Theater Camp, this, her Letterboxd account. I don't know how her LinkedIn account's going. I've got to check that out. But project after project, she is delivering big time. And, you know, I'm just excited to see this sort of as we bottom out the year with Ayo.
What's her Letterboxd account? What do you mean by that?
She's a really big movie fan. And so she launched this Letterboxd account, and she's just immediately, because she's the it girl of the moment, she's just racked up a huge number of followers because she's got really good taste in movies and always does like little reviews of things, and everyone's following her on Letterboxd. I've got to do that.
I've been doing it for 8 or 9 years now. I was in the first wave when they launched Letterboxd. So
but Simon, you're not AO.
No, that's true. No, I've got a bunch of followers though. All right, I'm going to check that out. I guess, but do get along and see Bottoms.
Yeah, very keen for that. And it is playing in cinemas right now and hopefully will be for the next week and a half. Probably longer. I don't know. Who can tell these days? Who can tell? Simon, something that is playing in cinemas right now, but will be on Netflix on the 7th of December, as it is a Netflix original and it will debut streaming the place that it was intended to be seen. It's a brand new... It's true, though. It's a Julia Roberts movie. It's called Leave the World Behind.
I went online this morning and I rented us a beautiful house out by the beach. I figured if I made the reservation and packed our bags, it would eliminate most of the reasons to say no.
Oh, this is nice. Kids look so happy.
The Wi-Fi isn't working. Get a pad.
I'm so sorry to bother you, and this is our house.
This is your house?
I mean, I'm just going to put the facts out there. Made for Netflix. It's got the Netflix logo at the beginning. It's playing in the bottom rung theaters in cinemas. It's not a big release. I did see a billboard for it, which is surprising.
Having seen the film, you can honestly say that you were glad you saw it on the big screen. The sound design was so important to this that some of the staging of the big stunts and the big action moments were crucial on the big screen. It certainly added to what was going on in the film.
I'd agree with part of what you said. One of the really cool things with this movie, let's talk about what the movie is, and then I'm going to talk about it as actually a good small screen experience and why. Okay. I'm going to talk about it that way. So first of all, the thing that drew me into this is it's the new movie by Sam Esmail. Sam Esmail, I believe this is actually only his second feature film, but he's got quite a few hours on the board at this point. So he made this romantic comedy that had a fairly sort of dark edge to it called Comets. It's fine. I didn't love it, but it's kind of interesting. And it does show a filmmaker who's got like an interesting take on the world and a fair bit of promise from a technical standpoint. On that, he met his soon-to-be wife, Emmy Rossum, who people also know from Shameless. Off the back of that, he ended up, he wrote the screenplay for what was going to be a movie called Mr. Robot, became a TV series. First season of that one, he directed a couple of episodes, but was like, you know, the key creative on the program, as most showrunners are. But from seasons 2 through 4, he took on the role as director. So every episode of that show has him directing it, and his directing style is off kilter. All the camera shots, nothing is centered. It's always well and truly left or right. It's somewhere on the screen. Action can often take place off in a far distant sort of moment while people's attention is elsewhere. And all of this is very deliberate. He is there to create a mood, a sensation, a vibe over every single scene that you're watching. And one of the other things that he does is he loves playing around with sound. So often there's some very sort of interesting sound design taking place. Often it'll get really loud and oppressive, again, deliberately so. He is a master at knowing what to bring to the screen as well as what to bring to your ears. Like, he is a proper craftsman, and it's always exciting to see something he's directed.
Totally
post Mr. Robot, although it may actually have been before the last season, I can't quite remember the timeline, he went off and directed a show for a Prime Video called Homecoming. It's based off a podcast. Julia Roberts was attached to it, and she's like, hey, let's bring this guy Sam Esmail in. So they had this meeting. They got along remarkably well. He directed this for her. I think he may have written the episodes as well. I think that might be true. But Homecoming, easily one of the best things Julia Roberts has ever done, pushed her in some really interesting directions from an acting perspective. And what he did with her in that series is similar to what he does with her in this movie, which is that Julia Roberts, incredibly charismatic. We all know that smile. She has driven so many rom-coms over the years, but then there's also been efforts for her to do proper dramatic work. You think about Aaron Brockovich as the obvious example, Steven Soderbergh directing that. He got at something from her. It was like a sort of more sort of darker seriousness, but also Aaron Brockovich, I think, still relied a fair bit on the charm of Julia Roberts. Like, that wasn't really lost to that. Whereas Sam Esmail seems to be completely jettisoning the charm almost entirely, although there is one scene in this where you see the Julia Roberts of Julia Roberts fore. Yeah. Okay, but largely what he does with her is that he has her acting in a very sort of insular way. I saw an interview with him today that referred to her character in this film as a Karen, But it's not really quite that. A Karen is someone who is overt and trying to use their privilege to get their way in the world. But that's not what her characters are. Her characters are people that have been beaten down by the world, dissatisfied, and don't really get much from personal interactions with other people. So they become very insular and very protective of their space. And her character in Homecoming is very similar to this in regards to that kind of a behavior. And Julia Roberts plays that remarkably well, because you want to see the Julia Roberts of the charming Julia Roberts come out, but it is so contained, and you know that she's in there somewhere, but she's just not letting herself let it out. And that becomes a really key character point for this show, for this film. But what's it about? We haven't actually talked about that at all. Premise of this movie, it's pretty simple. You got this guy, Ethan Hawke, wakes up in the morning to find that his wife, as played by Julia Roberts, she's packing up their stuff. They're going on a holiday. This wasn't a planned holiday. It's just like, what's going on? He's like, she says, we're off to this country house for the weekend. It's on Long Island. They live around like Brooklyn or something. You know, they're certainly Manhattanites. They're probably not Manhattanites if they live in Brooklyn. Whatever. They live in the city of New York. But anyway, it's like, we're going to go holiday over in Long Island. We're heading out. So it's like, okay, yeah, that's cool. They've got two kids. The girl is what, like probably about 11, 12-ish?
13, older, she says 13? In the film.
Yep. Okay, yeah, cool. Teenage boy who's, you know, 15, 16, a couple of years older. So they're not really quite sort of close. They're sort of fairly sort of strong antagonists. But like all brothers and sisters, they always kind of get lumped together. Well, he is a dick, but he's also a 15, 16-year-old boy with a, you know, little sister who's 13. Like, he's always going to be a dick to her. That's just kind of how that relationship is always going to play out. But they kind of like each other, but grudgingly at times. But they get lumped together as the story goes on. So anyway, they go to this place in Long Island. It's a gorgeous house. Like, it is possibly my dream home. I'm very into this house.
Top tier Airbnb.
But there, but there's a few things that are kind of a little bit hinky. First of all, the internet keeps on sort of being fairly patchy. They go to the beach and they see this oil tanker, which is off in a distance, but getting closer and closer to the beach. And so they're like, wait a second, it's way too close. Let's get out of here. And you see this oil tanker come right up on the beach. So that's a bit weird. They get home and find that TV signals aren't really working, and it's just, you know, it's hard to really sort of do much. But what I like about this, the smart choice, is that these are people who are on holiday, and those things where if you can't get your internet connection, like, there's nothing that frustrates you more. You're going to your router, you're trying to reset that thing, you're checking status websites online, like, you're trying to work out why it is that your thing isn't working, okay? But you don't do that if you're on holiday. If you're on holiday, you're like, ah, inconvenience, but I'd like to do this other thing over here instead. So it's not really a big thing for them, but it's a big thing for the girl who is just starting the final episode of Friends that she's been streaming for like a couple of months leading up to that. And she wants to know what happens with Ross and Rachel, but she can't because the internet isn't working. Huge issue for her. That evening, the kids have gone to bed and there's a knock at the door. There's a family, and it's noteworthy that they're African-American. Okay. It's Mahershala Ali. And also, I can't think of the name of the young actress, but she's the lead of industry. Mahalia. Yes, she's fantastic. Mahalia. I really like her. She's great. But she's the lead of industry where, you know, she's easily the best thing about industry by like a long shot. But the two of them are at the door. They both seem very reserved and standoffish, and there's something not quite right about them. And that is definitely felt by Julia Roberts, who wants nothing to do with people whatsoever. But they're like, hey, look, this is our house. Okay. We've ended up having to come back from the city. We were just at this event and, you know, we just kind of need to stay here for the night. So I'm sorry to do this to you. We'll refund you like part of your Airbnb fee. Anyway, Julia Roberts wants nothing to do with this, but Ethan Hawke plays an Ethan Hawke type character. He's kind of cool with it. They get ready to, you know, deal with the fact that they're going to be there that night. But anyway, as the next morning comes up, they start to realize that things really just aren't quite right with the world. And slowly that relationship starts defrosting. And as each of them are very guarded, they're also very open to their humanity as they're living in this house together. And that's kind of what this film becomes about. It becomes about these people who are on the on the precipice of possibly something really bad happening at an apocalyptic level. Something's going on. They don't know what it is. There's no information available to them. The guy, he's got a bit of an in that he's got a client who's a very wealthy guy who suddenly wanted all of his money moved into offshore accounts and just wanted his money moved around the place. So immediately that made the guy think there was something going on. And so something is happening. We still don't actually really know exactly what's taken place. There's some inferences made at the very end of the movie, but what you are seeing is civilization collapsing around the place for some reason, with a family who are really stuck trying to work out what do we do to protect ourselves, our family, and engage with our neighbors as suddenly everything's all going to pot. So this is a dramatic film with a very big, tangible threat taking
place. High stakes in it. Yeah.
Very high stakes. And you're also dealing with people who are scared and confused and trying to work out where their place is going to be in what is very much going to be a new world order. It's easily the best film I've seen so far this year. Is it going to be number one on my list? It's going to be skirting very close. I've got one or two more movies to see this year before I really sort of pull the pin on that one. But I think this might be the best thing I've seen all year. And for reasons of production, so the audio, the video, other just visual sort of style of it, as we've discussed, but also that cast, I think, are just fantastic in this. Julia Roberts, I haven't really seen this good, maybe really ever. Ethan Hawke is very Ethan Hawke. Like, that's always a positive for me. So, you know, on board for that. Mahershala Ali, I think he's fantastic. Ms. Industry, whose name I've forgotten already.
Mahalia.
Fantastic. The two teenage kids are both amazingly annoying and just awful, but also just a delight to watch on screen. And then there's one other supporting actor in this who I don't want to give it away. You do see him sort of early in the film, but he comes back at the end of the film in a really major way. But you're going to see some very cool stuff. Amazing. I do have one question, though, which is that there's something going on with the deer who live around this house. They keep on rocking up and want to have some sort of engagement, but there's nothing in this film that really allows that plot point to make a whole lot of sense to me. So I'll wave that away a little bit, but it's the only thing really within this film that isn't as tight as we saw from the, I think, master who made Mr. Robot, a show that I do like revere. I think that show was just incredible and heavily underwatched.
Few quick points I want to make, and great coverage of it. Yeah, it is a terrific film. I agree with all you've said. It was
hard to talk about because you don't want to give away like some of the twists.
No. And I won't be doing that. With regard to the animals, there's the constant sort of presence of these deer that are always around the house that seem to have a fascination with the family. I read into that the deer are kind of saying, hey, we know what's going on. You guys are in a whole lot of trouble. When are you going to get on your way? When are you going to move away? And we're on the verge of taking over again, especially that scene towards the end when they trap Julia and Mahalia in front of the shed. They're kind of saying, you know, these are your last moments. We're about to take over again. Because there's also the flamingos. There seems to be this breaking down of why the animals being fearful of us, and instead they just sort of understand that these are the final moments of this line of species. There's been a lot of talk in some of the coverage I've read of it that it's a Shyamalan-y kind of film, and to a certain extent that's true. It's there's a lot of Mr. X, and there's a lot of scenes of tremendous tension where you're not really quite sure why it's tense, but you certainly feel it. There's that incredible sequence in the middle where they cut between the three characters with Ethan Hawke in the car and the angry Spanish lady and the two kids in the forest. And there's always a pulsating sort of undercurrent sound design in there that drives those scenes forward. I would say, and I mentioned this to you in a text during the week, that it's even more like a Jordan Peele film. This is very much a post-Peele kind of thriller in that the tension that Mahalia supplies with regards to her relationship to Julia Roberts and Mahershala Ali trying to be sort of the sort of African-American man, but one full of grace and trying to find a balance in his society. And then you've got Ethan Hawke being the media studies academic type who's just trying to be cool with everyone. So there's a whole lot of race and class tensions in this that Peele excels at, as does Esmail. He handles it just as well, I think. So there's so much to work with in this film and so many moments that work as a terrific bit of entertainment. So Try and spin me how this could be, if not better, at least as good on the small screen.
Oh, sorry, we didn't really get to that. Just before we sort of swing to that, I think there's just like an interesting sort of racial component to this film as well, which, sorry, I said that there was a reason why I need to point out that it was an African-American family at the door. It's part of this sort of othering that's taking place. So I kind of feel like the daughter in that family sort of feels as though she's being othered. Whereas the Julia Roberts, I'm not sure that race necessarily really plays as big a role as much as she just kind of hates everyone and keeps everyone at a distance. So there is this kind of interesting tension that's taking place, you know, within that from perspectives as to how I guess conversations about race are taking place in the current moment. But in terms of TV, the reason why I think this plays just as well on the TV, okay, from a visual perspective, sound is different. So I think that the sound mix on this is absolutely incredible. And unless you've got like a really amazing sound setup at home, I do think you're going to miss out on something watching it on just like a standard TV with inbuilt speakers. But from a visual perspective, I don't think he does anything grander in this than what we saw with Mr. Robot. Mr. Robot really is a visual feast. And as he got more and more comfortable and confident as a filmmaker, especially in those last two seasons of the program, that show was big and visually rich. And part of what really sort of made that work is that there was a weird intimacy. And it's to do with that relationship of those off-kilter camera shots just play so much better when you're in the intimate surrounds of your lounge room versus on the big screen. I was able to appreciate it on the big screen, but I just kind of feel as though there was like a relationship aspect between me and the filmmaker, which was maybe lost on a canvas of that size. And it's only because I've seen his work before on the small screen and know just how well that resonates there. So if I was watching it, as you have been, as someone who wasn't really watching Mr. Robot, okay, and saw it up there going, oh, well, it's just visually really interesting and arresting. Yes, but also I kind of feel that he knows how to make this for the small screen, and I'm keen to see what it looks like on the small screen because I think it'll resonate, it'll pop there just as well.
Do you think at any point it was a 4 or 5 part series? Because it felt to me that there was some big sort of dialogue scenes that dropped in the third act of the that scene between Mahershala Ali and Julia Roberts where they're having a glass of wine and they end up dancing to the records, which was a beautiful hint as to its stance on physical media that played out in one of the best endings to a film, the best final, literally the final moments of a film I've seen in a long time. It's almost felt a little bit episodic in the way some of the things took place, and I think it would cut together as a 4 or 5 episode thriller series as well. Or is that just his background that...
Well, look, I mean, it might be in part just that he's been writing episodically for so much of his career at this point that maybe that sort of plays a role into it. But look, I mean, this is based on a book and, like, you know, you can speak to him and he'll tell you he wasn't being entirely faithful to the book. But I think it was very much envisioned to be meeting the challenges to what that book was offering and bringing that to the screen. But I do think that there is something about the apocalyptic... relationship drama genre, which really speaks to an episodic nature. Something I kept on thinking about throughout this was there's a mid-90s movie made by, oh gosh, I can't think of the name of the scriptwriter. He's one of the majors. It's this film called Trigger Point that has Colin McLaughlin and I think Elizabeth Shue was the female lead in it.
That was a Soderbergh film.
It wasn't, no, it's not Soderbergh directing it, unless he had like a producer or a role on it.
I think he wrote it, didn't he? Anyway, keep talking.
It's what's his name? Look it up. Yep. But
it's a Tui, David Tui film, I think.
Yeah, but written by.
Anyway, keep going.
You've got it there on the screen in front of you, Simon. Jeez.
No, okay. I haven't yet. I'm wrecking my brain.
Oh, no, I don't think it is David Tui. Gosh, anyway, Simon, yeah. Look it up, get some names before you just start throwing them at me.
I'm at fault here suddenly. You're the one who can't remember anything. All right, okay.
Well, I didn't expect to be going down this route. But there's a thing in that film where it starts out as a blackout taking place around Los Angeles. Yeah. And then invariably, as the way that a lot of these stories happen, they find themselves heading out into the desert to try to find salvage out there. And there just seems to be something where, like, if your third act isn't somewhere completely removed from where you were in the first act, it feels like a apocalyptic family drama isn't necessarily quite working. It just seems like it's a hallmark of the genre.
Yeah. Okay, it is a David Kerb, not David Toohey, the guy who wrote Jurassic Park, David Kerb film. And yes, it's a great film.
Is that how you pronounce it? I thought it was like Co-op, but...
Cope, maybe, something like that. But yeah, it's a terrific film.
Yeah.
And it's inspired by, and you mentioned in your review during the week, a terrific review on your Always Be Watching newsletter, that it's got a Twilight Zone feel to it. And the trigger effect, as it was called, not trigger point. Based loosely on the Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, one of the classic Twilight Zone episodes as well. So you're spot on in that observation as well. Do get along and try and see Leave the World Behind. It's a fantastic movie. You got to wait for Netflix to do it as well there.
Yeah, so it's not long to wait for it on Netflix. We're reviewing it on this week's show because it debuts next week. So it's on the 7th that you'll be able to stream this in the comfort of your own home. Invest in that soundbar, though.
Exactly right. All right, let's get on to another bit of apocalyptic doom, this time in the form of a giant lizard called Godzilla.
Never heard of him.
また悪い夢。ご両親空襲でやられたようです。兄さんも私と同じね。親子共々縁あってこうして引き取ったんだから。だから私はどんなことがあっても死んではいけない。
Godzilla Minus One is the new film from Toho Studios, the original studios in Japan that brought Godzilla to life back in 1954. That's off the top of my head. I hope I get that right. This one is the first time that the Godzilla story goes all the way back to a post-World War II setting. It is the story of a young kamikaze pilot who knows the war is ending and that Japan has lost and decides not to go through with his kamikaze mission. He lands on an island in the Pacific Ocean where he is brutally chastised by the mechanics that are on the ground there, only to be saved by a giant lizard coming out of the ocean and killing all but one of the mechanics. We move ahead a few months. The kamikaze pilot, failed kamikaze pilot, I guess you could say, has relocated back to the mainland, trying to rebuild his life, becomes friend with a woman who's also adopted a young orphan to look after. Together, they try to rebuild their lives together, but the lizard of law, Godzilla, has absorbed a whole lot of the Bikini Atoll nuclear test site material and is headed towards the shores, and it becomes the role of the young man to find some sort of redemption in his life by taking on the lizard with the help of his motley crew of merchant sailors and the like. What makes this Godzilla film so interesting, apart from the fact that it features some of the most incredible special effects you'll see on the big screen this year, is that its setting means there are no state-of-the-art battleships or jet fighters or nuclear missiles to try and kill Godzilla. This is all set against a country and a people that are already gutted by the dropping of the two atoms bombs and from losing World War II or their role in World War II. It really comes down to the acumen of this young man and the people around him to find it within themselves to beat this giant monster. The role that just the pure humanity takes on in defeating the lizard in this movie is so emotional. It's so resonating. It's a terrific piece of entertainment, not only as a massive special effects spectacle, and it certainly is that, but also as a really engaging dramatic story as well. So, you know, I'm a giant Godzilla fan, and I was really looking forward to this. I've more often than not been disappointed by the last few Godzilla films, the American ones through the legendary MonsterVerse period, but back in the hands of Toho Studios making their first Godzilla film since Shin Godzilla, which I didn't love. I certainly didn't love as anywhere near as much as I love Godzilla Minus One. It's in cinemas now, and yes, I'm going to plug it again. I did see this in IMAX, and it was an extraordinary experience. If you can see this on as big a screen as possible, do give it a go.
Yeah, I'm super keen to check this one out. It feels as though the the Japanese Godzilla movies, obviously the Toho produced ones, just creatively they're taking a lot more risks. So they're being far more creatively so risky than they used to be. Like, there was certainly a cookie cutter element to Godzilla films being pumped out over the years by Toho. I know the Godzilla aficionados will be, you know, just devastated at hearing a phrase like that, that there's a cookie cutter element to them, but come on. I mean, there kind of was, it wasn't being anywhere near as creatively bold as I think they were with both Shin Godzilla, as well as what it appears that they're doing here. And certainly you look at those American movies where I do think that they are being sort of more creatively bold with them. Like, their ambition these days is so much greater than it was when Emmerich did the 1998 Godzilla film. Mm. But even so, it's still, it's still not really quite up to par with what they seem to be doing with the new Japanese Godzilla films. And I'm very excited about what they've got here.
You should get along and see it. It is playing in limited release, but in through the major chains as we speak, released by a new distributor here in Australia called Sugoi, who are the company to go to for all your Japanese and anime titles moving forward. It's a company started up by a couple of the old bosses from Mad Men Entertainment. So they've kept their connections and are doing all the Japanese genre stuff here in Australia. So can't wait to see what they bring down the pipe later on. Godzilla Minus One in cinemas now.
Cool. Let's move on to a TV series, which, look, is this the TV series of 2023? No. Folks, it's called Faraday Downs.
My husband was killed in a faraway land. This place is so barren, I can't understand what he would have seen out here.
There she is, far away down. Australia. This should be interesting.
I think in the intro I called it Faraday Downs. It's far away downs because it's far away. It's all the way in Australia. Now, this is a TV series which used to be a movie. It was literally the movie Australia. Baz Luhrmann's, and to borrow a phrase that Simon drops around here way too frequently, it was a folly. Big budget movie, tanked terribly at the box office, critically derided.
No, it didn't. Don't keep saying that. It didn't tank. It actually made a lot of money internationally, and it hit about $30 million here in Australia. So I think on the international marketplace, it did very well.
Yeah, but it was off a budget of what, Simon? Like, it was a big budget.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, anyway, I'm going to get to that information before this podcast is out. But Simon, certainly critically derided. And was not quite met to the rapturous response that a lot of Baz Luhrmann films are mistakenly provided.
That is true.
I don't like Baz Luhrmann's films very much.
I know.
At all.
Yeah. Yeah, I got to go all the way back to Romeo and Juliet for one that I've really, really connected with. Mm. Everything else, there's always been something that's left me poopy.
Yeah, it's not for me. And that's fine. Not every movie has to be for me. But his movies definitely aren't for me. But I was kind of curious about the artistic approach to this, which is movie wasn't, embraced particularly all that much. It was an effort to make a epic style movie, a big sweeping romance using the land of Australia and, you know, all the action adventure that can take place while cattle rustling and all that sort of gear. I guess. I never saw the film. I'm putting it out there. Never watched it.
Oh, really? Okay. Yep.
I made a furtive attempt to see it, but that evening fell apart on me and I never got to see the movie, which ultimately just wasn't that great a loss. But it's back now. And so because the film wasn't well received, Baz Luhrmann thought, well, maybe it could be a TV series. And so the question is, can you take a big, long-ass movie like Australia, cut it into a TV series, trim out some scenes, add in some scenes, and does it look and feel like a TV show? And the answer to that is no. The first episode, which is the only thing I could stomach, I could not make it past this first episode. It doesn't fit the structure of a TV episode at all. If anything, it just looks like I've chosen to stop watching a movie after the first act. Like, that's all that's really happening here. And this is the thing. I don't think you can take a movie and just trim it down to operate as a TV series. A TV series is quite different to a movie in the way that you structure things, in the way that you film things, in the way that you approach material. it's not the same, and this didn't really prove that it was possible. I don't really know what to say about this, only because people know what that movie was. People know what this TV series is going to be, which is that it's a movie just chopped into five parts.
All right, let me come at it from a point of view of someone who did see the movie and who didn't hate the movie specifically. I kind of latched on what he was trying to do with it, and I mentioned to you during the week, it's kind of a Mills and Boone type, big, highly pitched, romantic epic along the lines of African Queen, with that sort of heightened, you know, muscular man. Hugh Jackman in one of those early episodes, you could see him sort of pouring the bucket of soapy water on himself when he's having a shower, and Nicole Kidman sort of, oh my, clutching her pearls in one of the most awful performances of her career, I must say. I'm totally a puppet of Lerman in what she does. And the first episode of this falls into this hideous sort of high-pitched romp with Australia and quite worryingly Australia's Indigenous people as a backdrop. The element of the film that I had largely forgotten about, but which I was reminded of in the first few minutes of episode one of this, of Far Away Downs, is the small Indigenous boy who falls under the care of Lady Boss or Boss Mrs. or whatever they end up calling Nicole Kidman in this. And the very Mrs. Boss and the very staggered English he uses, to the point of Lerman putting subtitles on his English, but not on her English, which is just as plummy and hard to understand. All the while Jackman is sort of just brooding his way as the drover through this. Now, I got past, because I was a little bit more interested in, and having seen the film, I was sort of keen to see where they went with the second and third episodes. And it does fall more into a kind of a drama on the outback on this property with the cattle and the horses and all that sort of stuff. It takes on a bit more of a TV series structure in those episodes two and three. But if anybody who hasn't seen the original film can get past episode one of Far Away Downs, you're a better person than I am, because it was just the most awful thing to watch. And you've got people like Bill Hunter and Ben Mendelsohn and Barry Otto, all the people that Lerman can attract because he's Baz Luhrmann, being made to do or choosing to do these awful broad characterizations. I swear to God, the first half hour of Far Away Downs was maybe the worst television I've seen in a decade. But I pushed through, and episodes two and three were at best watchable.
Quick question. So the episode, like the first episode at least, I'm sure this carries through the series, they've got a framing device where it's narration from the young kid. You know, is that something from the movie, or is this like an entirely new structural element for the series? Because it seemed to me that they were papering over a whole number of narrative holes in a way by providing this narrative over the top.
I have a memory of the boy having like a narrator's voice. Otherwise, there were long passages of his scenes that didn't have any dialogue. So I recall, and I'll be corrected if I'm wrong, but I think they were part of the film. I think the boy's journey was just as important. But even in that, I mean, Nicole Kidman's character plays such a white savior. The rest of the Indigenous population are all sort of either completely subservient to her, or these mystical, standing on a rocky outcrop kind of portrayal. And then you've got the Mickey Rooney version of a Chinese chef on the property, who's all sort of, you know, very heightened and very stereotypical in the way he's portrayed. So this, just so much about this film felt wrong. Just felt wrong.
Yeah, look, didn't care for it, happy to move on. Just for, filling in the narrative gap in this podcast, the movie, off the back of a $130 million budget, thereabouts, production budget, managed to make, $211 million? So when you consider that, usually you take a production budget, add about half onto it for marketing expenses. Okay, this brings us to a point where they made a little bit of money on it, but even so, I believe it would be what would be referred to within a studio system as disappointing.
Oh, disappointing. Very disappointing indeed. All right. Look, let me just mention very quickly what else I have been watching I watched the new Disney Plus Hulu series, A Murder at the End of the World, which is a very cool little show made by Britt Marling, who I'm a fan of. She's done some kind of off-kilter stuff in the past, and in this one she's takes the murder mystery construct, that basic little template for a storyline, and sets it all in on this Icelandic property owned by Clive Owen. A murder takes place, and this wonderful young detective, sort of this amateur sleuth type of girl, Darby Hart, played by the terrific Emma Corrin, who I hadn't heard of before, but now I realize played Princess Di in one of the episodes of the series of The Crown. So many people will know her.
Two seasons of it, Simon. Two seasons.
Two seasons of The Crown. Marling's there in the cast as well. Clive Owen, Elise Braga. There's a lot of quality to this, and it's got this beautiful sort of shimmery kind of look and feel to it. So two episodes in, I'm kind of hooked with A Murder at the End of the World on Disney Plus. That's what else I've been watching.
Yeah, I've been avoiding that one only because I've never really liked much of the content coming out from Britt Marling or her collaborators.
Oh, really?
Batman Lige. I don't know how you pronounce his surname, but it's got the word Batman in it, which I would have thought would be more appealing than it really is.
Yeah, no, very cool show. Very cool. What was the? She did an End of the World type thing a little while back, Another World or something. That was one of hers, which I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was that thing. Was the world like meeting another world? I don't remember. I didn't care for that film.
I can't remember.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, Simon.
Let's move on. Speaking of End of the World, let's get to the middle bit.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
As we kickstart our intermission here, we've got to think about the end of the world. It takes place about an hour and a half from now, so when it happens, surprised. Anyway, because we've got such a short amount of time to get through this, we're just going to list off three movies that deal with end-of-the-world themes that resonate the most with us. Simon, let's go with you first. No particular order, but give us one of the three for you.
All right, I'm going to lead off with something that doesn't immediately sort of scream out end of the world because it's a comedy, but I'm going to go with This Is the End. This is the one in which James Franco throws a giant celebrity party, and as the party's kicking on and going crazy with the types likes of Jay Baruchel and Seth Rogen and Jonah Hill and Danny McBride sort of all going crazy, the apocalypse happens. Demons start spewing up out of the grounds outside the palatial mansions of James Franco, and much hilarity and horror ensues. So in the truest sense of the word, this is an end of the world film, but it's also a very funny one, featuring one of the great comedic performances by a certain Michael Cera, who I absolutely loved in this film. So This Is the End is my first one.
Yeah, look, I'm a bit of a fan of that one as well. Something I'm going to throw in there is, I guess, maybe one of the all-time greats. Some people may say Planet of the Apes, but that is not an actual apocalyptic movie. But its sequel, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, absolutely a film that deals with the end of time. Like, quite literally, Charlton Heston's like, guys, I will come back and do your sequel, but I have to be killed off at the end. And they absolutely do that because they set off a nuclear bomb, which wipes out everybody. We see the proper end of the world in the final moments of what is a not very good movie and is the second worst of the five originals. Just
The first one isn't an apocalyptic film because I would have thought that all of mankind has been wiped out.
Look at Simon. He just looks at it from his perspective as a privileged white human being. No, the world hasn't ended. It ended some time ago for those privileged white human beings, but ape society has built itself up into a culture, and it's not ended. It's just that it's someone different to you, Simon, who's now in control.
Wow.
So
you've changed your tone after your big Babona monkey. What was the thing you did last week? Your Babona ape society thing? That's a change of tone for you, supporting the monkeys now.
I wasn't anti-monkey. In fact, I was. It doesn't even matter. It was the bonobo monkey, by the way. But that wasn't an end of society. That was we're just looking at the current society, and these pesky humans have come up along to just interrupt the whole thing. Those apes were perfectly happy enslaving humanity, like things were going fine for them.
Sure.
But it does end with a nuclear bomb in the second film. Didn't stop them from making a third movie, which is a direct sequel, but, you know, I'll let people watch it to discover how that happened. But anyway, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, one of my favorite end of the world movies, even though it's not a very good movie.
My second one, again, this doesn't scream out the horrors of the end of mankind, but it really is about how we've ruined our own planet. The movie is called WALL-E. It's a Pixar film, and it tells the story of a little robot called WALL-E who is left alone on Earth to move the trash around and build giant towers of trash to keep everything in order. He does it for hundreds of years, and he's gotten a bit lonely, and he's open to love. And this end of the world story, or the world having ended story, turns into a very sweet, soaring kind of romantic epic, as only Pixar can do so well. So WALL-E is my second apocalyptic film.
Yeah. The film I was going to throw out there is a Canadian independent movie called Last Night, written and directed by Don McKellar. It's a film about some people in, I think, Toronto. It's definitely a Canadian city. Just about how they spend the last night on Earth as something's going to take place. It's a really good, really low-key character drama. So it came out the same time that Armageddon was playing in cinemas. Think about the disparity of the two. Armageddon, it's the American rah-rah, let's get into space and blow up that asteroid to stop from destroying us. Meanwhile, the Canadian version of that is, oh, well, something's going to happen, so how about we just sit around and just, you know, deal with it as it takes place. You never actually find out. It never really exactly sort of explains what's taking place, but everything goes white at the very end. That indicates that the sun was doing something. Really great film. Great sort of cast in it as well. So Don McKellar, who I've got a lot of time for. Sandra Oh was the, eventual kind of love interest, sort of. But then just a whole bunch of Canadian actors, Robin Gamble, Sarah Polley's in there, David Cronenberg, Callum Keith Rennie, just a whole bunch of faces that you've suddenly seen if you've watched a Canadian movie.
Have to check that one out. Haven't seen that one. My third one is a film that starts off with the complete desolation of a major metropolis. The people have all but gone, the population disappeared, except one pre-slap Will Smith. The movie is called I Am Legend. He plays a scientist who's one of the lone survivors of a man-made plague outbreak. He's trying to navigate through an empty New York City with his beautiful German Shepherd dog in the hope of finding other survivors. I think this is a terrifically exciting, very tense, the end of the world thriller. I still think it's the best thing Will Smith has done. The scene, spoiler alert, in which the dog gets nipped by the nighttime, they're not zombies, I guess, but the infected, I guess you could say, is really, really moving stuff. So I Am Legend is just a bit of a favorite of mine. I keep going back to it and watch it again over and over. I think it's his best work.
Yeah, I saw that movie once. That was enough.
Once is enough.
Snowpiercer. That's my third and final one. You don't get more end of the universe than that, except for maybe that Planet of the Apes film where they blew everything up. Those maniacs, they blew it up. Damn them. Damn them all to hell. Snowpiercer, train, last lot of humanity traveling around, and it's about that sort of poor versus the wealthy, and just, you know, how delicious can a baby be is probably one of the questions that the film never really resolves for us.
Very true. I do want to point out very quickly that there's a great Aussie film called These Final Hours, which is also a terrific end of the world thriller, which is literally an end of the world thriller. Anguri Rice. I can't remember the young guy who was in it, but it's a terrific film from Aussie director Zach Hilditch.
I don't know if that's a terrific film, but it's certainly, I think, a fairly arresting movie with a number of sequences that have always stuck with me since seeing it.
Oh, for sure, yeah. Yeah, no, good stuff. All right, there's lots more out there. Jump on screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com tell us your favorite end of the world movie. There's so many to choose from, but definitely worth having a look at. Good intermission, worthy of the 150th screen watching episode, Dan Barrett. Well done. This day in history. All right, let's whip through these. I think you'll get all of these without any problem, Dan Barrett. December 3, 1952. Which U.S. state gets its first television broadcast? December
3, 1952. So I saw these questions earlier in the week, and I looked at that and thought, I have no idea what this is. So I actually did look it up, and apparently it's Hawaii.
It's Hawaii, exactly right. Yes, yeah, got the its first broadcast. Don't know what it was. Also on December 3, but
surely it was an Elvis forward movie, a few right?
Probably was, yeah. Oh, clever. Probably Blue Hawaii is what you're saying. December 3, 1983, the Broadway musical Marilyn, an American Fable, bombs, shutting after only 17 performances, despite starring a young actor who would eventually find fame as a beloved TV leading man. What was his name?
So usually I don't actually care enough to look these up, but it was actually this musical that kind of got me looking it up because I'd never heard of it before. So I certainly didn't know who the actor was, and I was kind of curious to know who it'd be. But, oh boy, it was Scott Bakula.
It was rhymes with not Dracula. It's Scott Bakula. That's right. He was a young leading man. I can't remember who played Marilyn in this. I did look it up when I looked at the questions. But December 7, 1990, she's a film icon, part of a Hollywood dynasty. He's a brash businessman who changed how news was delivered to the world. On this day, they got engaged. Can you name this couple? December 7, 1990.
I absolutely could name this one because, come on, look who you're dealing with here. This is an amateur time. We are talking, of course, about Jane Fonda with her then, then fiancé, Mr. Theodore Turner.
That's right, old Teddy boy. Did well scoring Jane Fonda post all that aerobics.
Well, it helped because he was very wealthy.
Oh, yeah, that always helps. That, when you got Turner, when you got Turner dollars, you can get any
goes a long way.
Hollywood royalty.
Now, a number of years ago now, there was the Goodwill Games that was a sporting event that was sponsored by Ted Turner.
Oh, yeah.
And so he came to Australia to celebrate the Goodwill Games. And I believe he had his wife with him when I walked past him on the street.
I knew what you were going to say. You had a Turner moment. That's incredible. Mm. Was he an imposing figure?
I recognized him on the street. I wouldn't say that he was an imposing figure, but also I just kind of think that at the time, the fact that I was looking at Ted Turner and his, beautiful bride, neither of them really meant too much to me at that point in time. It's like how I saw Charlton Heston once, and I hadn't seen any Charlton Heston films up until that point. So it was just kind of like, oh, okay, it's Charlton Heston. That's kind of interesting. Yep. Okay. But it just didn't really mean anything to me. But if I'd seen that today, if I got to see Charlton Heston today, there'd be questions asked.
Well, it'd be messy. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Did you see him at the gun club that you were a member of for years? Is that where you bumped into him at the NRA?
Sadly not.
All right, let's get on to the birthday quiz.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no. Not happy birthday.
Now, each one of these has played what I believe is a pillar of the modern community. Let's see if you can answer this question. December 3, 1979, funny lady and celebrity DUI, Tiffany Haddish. December 3, 1979. Mm. December 3, 1960, the beautiful Julianne Moore. December 4, 1949, Jeff Bridges. And December 6, 1948, arguably my favorite Spielberg mum, Jo Beth Williams, who I adore from the Poltergeist film, and also The Big Chill and a couple of other ones. Now, these have all played a certain type of character, a certain type of profession, I might say. What might that be? And can you name the films? Oh, shit, I hope I
wrote them down. So, there's a lot of filmography for at least three of these actors. But the person who doesn't have a particularly deep bench of filmography is one Tiffany Haddish. So I kind of, I figure the answer is there. My assumption, and I can't connect this, but I'm pretty sure this is where it's heading. My assumption is we're going to talk about them being police officers or detectives at least. I'm going to say police detectives. And that's off the back of Haddish starring in The After Party for Apple TV Plus.
Interesting.
I kind of feel that if you go through the filmography of the three other actors, at some point they'll have at least played a cop.
Probably, yeah. Or some kind of investigator. Yeah, that's not the answer. The answer is they've all played teachers. Tiffany Haddish was in Night School opposite Kevin Hart. Julianne Moore was in a film literally called The English Teacher. Jeff played the English teacher. Jeff Bridges was a school teacher, headmaster, who took a bunch of kids out on a boat in White Squall. And Jo Beth Williams had one of her most memorable moments on screen in a movie opposite Nick Nolte called Teachers, in which she strips down and runs naked through the halls of a high school. Okay. Very hard to find Teachers. Yeah, I haven't seen that in many, many years. Sold at the movies, but don't think it's on any of the streaming platforms.
You suddenly sold it quite nicely.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, big fan of Jo Beth Williams. Well, she's done two nude scenes. One of the things I was going to go with.
Sorry, when did this podcast turn into Mr. Skin? When did that rebranding happen?
About 14 seconds ago. But it was, I took ages to find a connection between all these this week's birthdays, and there was a lot of them. But both Jo Beth Williams and Julianne Moore have done full frontal nudity, but I just couldn't find any more. So, plus, I thought that was a bit tacky. And yet, here we are talking about it.
Yeah. Where's the Tiffany Haddish nude scenes? Where's that?
Oh, I'm sure it's happened. But there was also, this week's birthdays also had Kim Basinger, also had Terry Hatcher, also had, there was a bunch of really big, beautiful stars. I know. And they're spectacular. So anyway, that brings us to the end of our 150th podcast. Dan Barrett, congratulations, mate, for all the work you've put into putting this together. I look forward to 151.
Folks, you have been listening to Mr. Skin, the podcast. My name's not relevant now. Gonna have to scrub history. Joined by Simon Foster, _.
Are we doing Simon our sign-offs? We Foster. Should mention. Yeah. That's right. You can find us on Facebook @ScreenWatchingPodcast, on X @Screen_Watching, on YouTube @ScreenWatching, all one word. Like I mentioned, email ScreenWatchingPodcast@gmail.com if you want to complain at all about anything we've said or ask us questions, or tell us your favorite apocalyptic film. And all my writings are at screen-space.net.
Yeah. Now Simon and I are about to go off into an editorial meeting about whether we should still be posting to X, as all the notable media companies from around the world have stopped. But anyway, folks, we'll have that conversation off mic. This has been Screen Watching. We'll be back next week. If we have done personal plugs, find me at alwaysbewatching.com. I've got a newsletter there. It's about TV and film stuff. Simon, what have you got?
I've done it all just then. Screen-space.net. You can find it all there. All I like. But yeah, do get in touch with us at Screen Watching Podcast. And thank you, everyone, for listening for 150 odd episodes. I know we've got a lot of regulars out there who do tune in, and it's always, we're very lucky to have you listening to us. Gab on. Oh, hey, did you just see very quickly? Well, just as this ends, the new trailer for Furiosa just dropped, the George Miller prequel to, I know you love your prequels, to Mad Max Fury Road. And boy, it is a very impressive trailer. Go to our Facebook page and our YouTube page. I've put them both up there to check out.
Technically, isn't every movie a prequel to Mad Max Fury Road?
Well, yeah, actually, you make a good point.
Folks, this has been Screen Watching. We'll be back next week.